for a while now, this picture has been floating around on the internet. You've probably seen it. The photo is a simple black and white grainy still of a young girl in the woods. The girl has a dark shadow over her face and is posing in a strange, standing position. There has been some debate as to whether she is running, jumping, or simply posing for the camera. The story surrounding the photo has only added to the intrigue. Apparently, this photo was discovered on a trail cam in Cambridge, New York. If you don't know, trail cams are specialized equipment used by hunters, researchers, and farmers to track game and other wild animals. These cameras are made to snap a picture when a motion sensor picks up movement in the lens's view. The landowners had set up this trail cam for hunting purposes. There are people on the internet who have latched onto the idea that this picture is of a long-dead girl, that this picture is of a ghastly presence. Others yet wonder if this is just a girl and why she might be alone in the woods. Police have gotten involved to find the identity of this person. This afternoon, I saw the picture while screwing around on Facebook during my lunch break at work. When I saw it, I froze. I knew who was in the picture. I knew the girl, and it was a face I hadn't seen in years. I left work early. I had to call my mom and get the facts straight, but I'm getting ahead of myself. After all, what else can I do but tell a bunch of scary story junkies what I have to say? Nobody would ever believe me anyways. Nobody I told believed me. My name is Rebecca, but everyone just calls me Becca these days. I grew up in Coyla, a small township within Cambridge, New York. Compared to the hustle of my current home in Manhattan, Coyla was a hole. I'm pretty sure more people live in my apartment building than lived in all of Coyla. My best friend was Zoe. Zoe was fun, brave, and so adventurous. God, I haven't thought about her in years. You could probably say Zoe was my first love. Of course, at our age, I was too young to see it that way. But isn't that how you always see friends from the past? They are a grainy photograph in your mind's eye, a caricature. You remember all of the good and ignore all the bad. I was 12 years old on the last day I saw Zoe. Every small town has rumors, and Coyla was no different. In the late 1980s, the rumor mill was spinning stories about a satanic cult. If you've ever heard a cult story, and I'm guessing you have, then these stories were nothing too shocking. Rituals in the woods, animal sacrifices, evil chants overheard in the trees. These were the stories spread from child to child, and unbeknownst to me at the time, adults as well. Supposedly, a cult had taken residence in a house in the woods around Cambridge in Coyla, and were privy to these and more depravities. The word on the playground in elementary school was exaggerated to the 10th degree. According to my old friend Ricky Davis, these cultists would kidnap the children. After they would abduct them, they would kill them and use their blood to make cranberry juice. The worst juice of all, according to Ricky. I know this sounds silly, but you have to understand, this is what we thought about these supposed cultists at the time. We were kids in the 80s in a small town. We had no internet. We were much more sheltered to the realities of the world than today's kids. If I'd even have had a clue as to what was really out there, things would have been different. Anyhow, back to Zoe. I met Zoe about a week before kindergarten. Her family had just moved from Manhattan to settle in a quiet community. The house they settled on ended up being right across the street from my house. Being the same age, Zoe and I became fast friends. We stayed over with each other, ate dinner at each other's houses, and did virtually everything together. By first grade, our parents would joke that they shared a pair of daughters. In the summer of 1989, we were both 12. It was the summer between 5th and 6th grades, a big year. We were headed to middle school. This year would be all about lockers and class schedules and puberty. Zoe and I were so close by this point, though, that we weren't too scared. Transition meant change, but we had each other. We were taking four of our seven classes together and were excited to see what was in store. The week before school started back up, we were more worried about how to make the best of our last week of freedom than we were about school. Of course, at this time, the cult stories were as big as ever. On the Friday before school was scheduled to start, I awoke lying next to Zoe in her bed. She was still fast asleep. I remember watching her sleep and thinking about how pretty she was. There was a time when I had wished Zoe were a boy. A part of me wanted to kiss her, and it would have been so much easier if she had just been a boy. Zoe was my best friend. Looking back, I guess it's only natural I felt that way. It was a very confusing time in my life. As I laid there, a clatter came from downstairs. Zoe had a big family, two brothers, two sisters, and a dog. All that, in addition to mom and dad, and there was seldom much quiet time in Zoe's house after 7 a.m. Zoe slowly opened her eyes and looked at me. The morning sunlight from her bedroom window swam through her dark hair. "Creeper," Zoe yawned at me. I scoffed. "I was just trying to wake your lazy butt up with the power of my eyes. Did it work?" "Eh," she said, rubbing her eyes. "Something like that." "Hey," I said nervously, "about what we talked about yesterday. We don't have to. Like, nobody will care." "And let that little dork Ricky get one over on us? No way. We're doing it." We got up and went downstairs to enjoy our breakfast of champions, Frosted Flakes, and get our day started. We already had our day planned. The previous day, we ran into Ricky Davis near the school. Now, a few years older than his cranberry juice-hating self, Ricky had evolved into something of a class clown. He and his core friends would always prank and dare people to do stupid things. He wasn't a bad guy, just a little obnoxious. While we were strolling home from the nearby corner store with quite the candy haul, Ricky saw us while riding his bike and made a beeline for us. "Hey guys, did you hear?" he asked, slightly out of breath from his stressful pedaling. "We found the house." Confused, Zoe asked, "What house?" "The cult house," Ricky exclaimed. "No way, you're full of it," I said. "I did, really. Yesterday morning, my dad and I were out hunting, and we saw this old house out there. It was really huge, but looked like it was falling apart. My dad said he saw footprints leading to the house, and we should just leave it alone, but it was totally the cult house." Zoe eyed Ricky skeptically. "So you saw some old house, and it's just supposed to be the cult house? I don't buy it." "No, think about it," Ricky pressed. "An old house in the woods. Lots of footprints. It has to be the cult house. You guys need to check it out." Ricky seemed thrilled by the concept, and I was a little more wary. "You want us to go out to some nasty house in the woods and waste our time making you look stupid when it isn't the house anyways? No thanks." He snickered at me. "If you girls are scared, then just say so." And with that comment, I knew we were going. Zoe was a lot of things. She slacked on homework. She didn't like to do her chores. She even had been known to get mouthy with teachers from time to time. But nobody called Zoe chicken. Zoe never stepped down from a challenge. "Look," Zoe said almost angry. "If you want us to go look at your stupid house and prove you wrong, then we'll do it. We'll do it tomorrow. We aren't scared." Zoe then puffed her chest out slightly. I, on the other hand, was less enthused. "I thought we were going to the mall with your sisters tomorrow," I said. "Oh, come on, Becca. We can get ice cream and pretzels anytime. Besides, this moron needs to be taught not to believe everything he thinks and sees." Zoe never bought into the whole cult story. Her dad was a history professor at a nearby college. His personal motto in life was "question everything," something which had definitely rubbed off on her. When she heard the cult stories, her dad had told her that many small towns make up stories about things that go bump in the night, and that these stories are seldom anything of merit. Zoe saw the stories as nothing more than pure bullshit. I was less rational about the call stories. Looking back, I think if you'd asked me directly, I would have said I didn't believe it, but it still freaked me out. And furthermore, and probably most important, I was comfortable not knowing at all. While I did want to hang out with Zoe, I didn't want to go into those woods looking for a cultic site. "Well, shouldn't we talk about it?" I started, and then Ricky interrupted me. "Hey, if Becca's too scared, I can go out there with you." That comment got to me. Ricky was one of the few black boys at our school. Maybe it was because of this that a lot of girls liked him. I always heard girls giggle about their crushes on him. Years later, Ricky would go on to be the captain of the high school baseball team and would go through girls about as quickly as he went through baseballs. He was that guy. I didn't realize why at the time, but I was not okay with Zoe being alone with Ricky in the woods. "I'm not scared. Zoe and I will go out there, and you're going to feel like an idiot once this gets out." And then right then and there, it was settled. That night, I stayed at Zoe's. We were up late into the night, looking at the map Ricky had eventually drawn us and planning what we would need to bring with us into the woods. Mostly just a few basic survival items and junk food. It was an unusually cool morning for mid-August, so we bundled up accordingly. The local weatherman forecasted cloudy skies and cool temperatures for the weekend, much to the chagrin of Zoe's parents. After finishing our breakfast, we headed out to the school, just up the road from our houses. According to Ricky's map, the woods behind the school would be the best place to start. At the school, we stopped under the moonlight to be sure we had everything we needed. The moonlight was another local curiosity. Next to the school in the parking lot was a huge light post that had been installed years ago. Due to some electrical malfunction that I didn't really understand, it glowed brighter than the surrounding lights. Due to its near blinding intensity, it had been dubbed the Moonlight by the locals. As we walked from the moonlight through the open field separating the brownstone school building from the tree line, I felt uneasy. Coila is a small place, as I've mentioned. It's normal for people to be out walking dogs, gardening, mowing lawns. But there was none of that. Nobody was around at all. No kids on the playground. No teachers going back and forth from their cars while preparing classrooms. Nothing. I suddenly felt alone. I quickened my pace to make sure I was side by side with Zoe. She made me feel safe. The woods in Coila are much the same as the woods in your own hometowns. Lots of fallen trees, worn paths from decades of playing kids, beer and liquor bottles left over from nights of teenage debauchery. Typical. From the map and Ricky's testimonial, we estimated it would take about an hour and a half to get to the house, if it really was there. While walking through the woods towards the house, we talked about what you would expect a couple of preteen girls to talk about. What movies did we want to see? Which girls did we hope wouldn't be in our classes? How would we rub it in Ricky's face when we proved him wrong? And eventually, our minds started to turn toward the cult stories. "Did you hear the rumor that Principal Van Dressen is in the cult?" I asked Zoe. And she laughed. "Yeah, and so is the librarian and the janitor, Mr. Nick. My dad, too, apparently." "Really, your dad?" I laughed. "Who said that?" "Lisa." She had the nerve to say it to my face. "She said the only reason I have a nice house is because my dad is in the cult." "Yeah, forget her. She's just jealous because her mom is a waitress." "Ouch, Becca, that's cold." We both then burst into a fit of hysterics. In our minds, if there really was a cult, none of these people would be in it. Every few months, a teacher would give someone a bad grade or a write-up, and within hours, that teacher was suddenly the cult leader. Rumors would spread for a while before a new target was eventually found. This is what really made the cult story so scary, the fact that anyone could be in it. There were always rumors being spread. If stories were to be believed, just about everyone in town had been a cultist at one point or another. If a cult really did exist, it was formed by everybody and nobody. About an hour and 40 minutes in, I realized that the forest was subtly changing. Gone were beaten paths and the abandoned refuse of our elders. I noticed how clean the area was. Not just free of trash, but free of typical forest debris as well. It was as if the area had been picked through numerous times for firewood. Twigs, sticks, leaves, most of these things were just gone. I was about to tell Zoe when, oh my God, he was telling the truth. It took me a moment before I realized what Zoe was talking about. Ahead through a clearing was a structure. Wordlessly, we walked forward to get a better look. The house was not as large as I had pictured. From Ricky's description, I imagined this huge, sprawling mansion. But what we saw, while large, was much more modest than my imagination had led me to believe. The simple two-story house seemed to be only slightly larger than my own house. The windows that weren't boarded up were long since shattered. The color seemed to have once been a pale blue, but much of the paint seemed to have chipped away, revealing splintered wood. There was no front door. It looked a lot like the old house from Leave It to Beaver, if that house had been abandoned for decades. In front of the house was a large fire pit. Well, damn, Zoe said. Yeah, well, he was right. What do we do now? I responded. I guess we go inside and look. It looks like the cultists aren't home, she smirked. Zoe, we came, we saw it, it's here. Can we just go? Like, this is really freaky. No way. We came this far. We at least need to find a souvenir to prove we did it. Well, maybe you're positive nobody is here, but I'm not. I could feel my heart pumping now. I couldn't explain why, but I was terrified. Every adult had always told me that stories of a cult house out in the woods were just stories. Yet here it was. Part of me was afraid that at any moment, someone would jump out and grab me or Zoe. Damn it, Bex, come on. I didn't hike through the woods for nothing. If you want to sit out here like a baby, then fine, but I'm going in. She turned away and started into the house. As I stood there and watched her walk away, I felt my dread deepen. I was afraid of being alone, but I was more afraid for Zoe. My best friend was going into certain doom and I couldn't stop her. I wanted to cry. Zoe, please, I shouted. Zoe stopped and turned around to look at me with anger in her face. I felt a tear run down my cheek. I'm really scared, Zoe. Please. And then my voice trailed off. Zoe saw the look on my face and sighed. Her face softened. She looked back at the house towards the porch. Sitting on the porch was a smooth black stone. Hey, look at this, she said as she bent over to pick it up. Do you know what this is? No, I don't. I wiped my tears away. This looks like a pretty good souvenir. Let's get going, Bex. I smiled, relieved, as Zoe walked up to me. She pulled me into a hug and apologized. I felt her warmth against me. It felt good, and for a minute, we just stood there and embraced. Oh, hey there. We quickly let go of each other and turned our heads towards the sound. Faster than I thought possible, Zoe's hand had darted down and found my own, and she squeezed hard. Just ahead of the house, we heard a heavy trudging through the brush. Through the thin tree line in front of the house stepped a man. He was a large, burly man. His tattered New York Mets cap hid dark hair. He wore faded, muddy jeans, a red flannel shirt, and a scraggly beard. In his left hand, balanced on his shoulder, was an axe. I felt the color drain from my face. The cultists, they were here. That axe was the last thing I would ever see. I couldn't take my eyes off of it. I felt my hands tense in Zoe's, her pounding heartbeat echoed into my palm. The woodcutter met our gaze and quickly tossed the axe into the dirt. Oh, no, girls, the man said with his palms flat out. It's okay. I'm not going to hurt you. I was just clearing some brush out here, collecting wood, that's all. It's okay, really. Zoe's grip loosened slightly, and then she sighed and let go. Oh, okay, you just scared us. What are you doing out here? The man laughed. What am I doing out here? I own that place. I'm fixing it up so I can rent it out to campers. What are you doing out here? We awkwardly explained why we had come out this far, telling the man about Ricky and the cult house. The man listened patiently, chuckling whenever the cult came up. Well, little ladies, I can assure you that this is not a cult house. I'm a godly man, the man said after listening to our story. Look, we're sorry, mister. We didn't mean any harm. We just wanted to see for ourselves. We should probably get going before our parents start to worry. In my head, I cursed Ricky. He probably met this guy too and sent us out here to mess with us. The man smiled. You two seem like good girls. Why don't I give you a ride home? It's only a 15-minute drive to town. No, that's okay. We know the way. I'm sure you do. But just tell me one thing. Are you both alone out here? What? Zoe asked. Are you alone? The man repeated with a little smile on his face. I turned away from the man to face Zoe, who looked appalled. Before I could respond, I felt the sharp pain on the back of my head before the world faded to black. I awoke after what must have been hours. It was dark out now. My head ached immensely. I was on the ground, tied up around my wrists and ankles with thick rope. I looked around and realized I was still next to the house. From behind, I could feel the warmth of a bonfire. Flipping over, I saw the largest fire I had ever seen. The tips of the flame were taller than the house before it. On the other side of the fire was Zoe. She too was bound. She was awake and looking at me with a horrified look on her face. I immediately thought back to my backpack I brought with us. Zoe's dad insisted we bring a pocket knife if we were exploring in the woods. Zoe, it's okay. Where's my pack? There's a... And Zoe cut me off. Bex. Tears were pouring down her face as she said my name. But she wasn't looking at me. I turned around. In the dark, I hadn't seen them before. But now they were all I could see. A dozen or so figures stood at the tree line. Each person wore a long black cloak with black gloves. They were all identical, save for one feature. Each wore a nearly identical mask. They were white, expressionless masks. The only thing setting them apart was red. Several of the members in the back wore all white masks. The rest had varying numbers of red dots painted on the masks. However, the one standing closest to me, that mask was completely blood red. The robes they wore hid their features well. Some were tall, others short. Some were heavier than others. Several even bore the unmistakable curves of women. However, no identities could be discerned from this. The one with the red mask then stepped forward. Brothers and sisters of the knighthood, our time is nigh, he spoke in a deep voice. He was tall, but not the tallest among them. Even under his billowing robe, he seemed very thin. We, the knights who have promised ourselves to the mighty King of Darkness, have come to make an offering to our Lord. Hail Deimos, the rest said in unison. I then started sobbing uncontrollably. Fear took me completely. Behind me, I heard Zoe pleading for them to stop. She kept saying she was sorry and that we wouldn't tell anyone. I couldn't muster the words to disagree or agree. I was lost in my own horror. The leader paid us no mind and continued. These beautiful ones shall make a glorious sacrifice for the coming of our Lord of the Wood. Hail Deimos! The group converged and circled around us in a loose circle. We make an offering to you, O Lord. In unison, they began to chant, in almost sing-song fashion in a tongue I didn't understand. Quaesimus, domin, dominus noster tenebris, et tu sisai penedecum, hanc pulchre, domine, munus primarum, sit vobis famin satire se properat, ambuls interno se quae aeternum. This chanting continued again and again and again, for minutes, or hours, or days, I was lost to it. The rhythm took me. I almost would compare it to being drunk. My head swam. It made me feel so tired. When the chanting eventually did stop, the group cried out one final time in unison, "Hail Deimos!" With everything that had happened thus far, this was the most horrifying event of my or anyone's life. I laid there, listening to their chant, knowing I was going to die, knowing Zoe would die. This was a terrible realization for any person to be faced with. But what happened next was worse. Done with their chanting, the cultists were ready for us. The futility of it all set in, and I was just lost in my own world. The man in the red mask walked over to the house and procured a black goblet. He walked over and ordered me to drink from it. I probably should have resisted, fought, struggled, something. But I had nothing left in me to fight with. I was nothing. I leaned my head forward and sipped the vile black liquid. It tasted like rotten eggs mixed with fire. The liquid burned me from the inside. The pain was maddening. Worse than anything I had ever felt. I was dying. I knew it. I was finally dying. I vaguely remember hearing Zoe scream my name as the darkness took me. I was still screaming when I lost consciousness. When I awoke, I heard sobbing. My head ached and my throat burned. I looked around to gather my surroundings. The remains of a small campfire lay before me. He told me he would see me in the afterlife, Zoe said. I looked over to see Zoe sobbing into her knees. I had no idea what she meant. I just laid there watching her, confined to my own thoughts. I felt useless. Nothing. Dirty. I was nothing and nobody. I realized we were no longer in front of the house. The area looked more like one of the campsites littering our woods. It was still dark. "Zoe," I started, but I had nothing to say. I realized how cold I was. I slowly stood and walked over to Zoe and put my arms around her. She finally seemed to realize I was there, held me tight, and cried. To this day, I have never heard or felt such anguish that was in that clearing that night. She cried, then I cried. We must have sat there holding on to each other for hours before we finally mustered the courage to stand. Upon examining our surroundings, I realized how dark it was. And how alone we were. At least I thought we were. At the other side of the dead campfire was one of the robed figures. He was laying with his back rolled against a large sitting log. We cautiously approached the figure. When we inspected him more closely, we saw that the man's ribcage had been torn open. The inside of his chest was completely exposed. His face bore a solid red mask. If I had seen this gruesome sight only hours ago, I would have screamed. I would have cried. But I was not the same girl I had been hours ago. Now I was nothing. I became aware that Zoe was holding my hand. I looked at her and she seemed to have regained some of her strength. "Are you okay?" she asked. "Yeah," I responded. "Let's go home." Having been there in the woods a lot, I had a pretty good idea of where people like to camp. This gave me a rough idea of where we were. I picked a direction and we started walking. For about a half hour, we just walked silently, hand in hand. Eventually, I heard Zoe say, "I'm so sorry I dragged us out here, Becca." We then stopped and I faced her. I wanted to scream that it was her fault. I wanted to scream that it wasn't her fault. But I had nothing. I had nothing to say. Instead, I just said, "Okay." It was shortly after that, through the brush, we saw a huge bright light in the sky. The moonlight. I could hear Zoe smile as she said it. And then I heard it. It started as a noise, off in the distance. Crunching, trampling, pounding. It sounded like some large animal was charging through the forest straight at us. We didn't wait to see it. I looked down and took Zoe's dark hand and started running harder than I ever had. After our ordeal, I didn't think we could run like that anymore. We charged recklessly through the brush, but despite our haste, the stomping behind us grew louder. The pounding was now accompanied by a monstrous roar, a roar which would send beasts of any kind fleeing in terror. The moonlight grew brighter. I could see the edge of the tree line and feel the heat of hot breath against my neck. The rancid air smelled of rotten eggs and fire. I burst forth from the woods like a swimmer out of water, gasping for air. I kept charging forward with every ounce of my strength before collapsing under the gorgeous majesty of the moonlight. In that exact moment, I thought, I'll die here. The sound then stopped. I just laid there panting. I was cut and bruised from my charge through the brush. I was bleeding. We had experienced a terrible trauma, but Zoe and I had made it out alive. My hand was empty. Zoe? I asked through panting breaths. Zoe? I looked around, but she was nowhere. Zoe! I thought I couldn't possibly cry any more tears. The tears started to come freely nonetheless. I stood feebly. The woods, I thought. I started to walk towards the woods to find Zoe when I saw it. Just inside the tree line was a massive silhouette, easily 15 feet tall. The shadow seemed to be heaving, exhausted from its chase. Right in the spot where eyes would be were two glowing red orbs. His eyes. In those deep crimson eyes, I felt pain. I felt longing, anger, suffering, hatred. But most of all, evil. Whatever this creature was, a demon, a god, the devil himself, he wanted me. I felt the pull of its murderous desire for me at a time when I should have had no understanding of what that meant. I was not meant to escape. I stared for about a minute, cursing whatever it was that stood in front of me, hating it. However, faced with this evil forth the depths of hell, I was filled with even more terror than fury. And suddenly, the entire tree line flashed red, then blue, then red again. I heard a car pull up and screech to a halt behind me, and I turned to see a police car. I looked back at the tree line, but the shadow was gone. Zoe and I had been gone for 3 days. In that time, the towns of Coyle and Cambridge had been completely upturned. Police from neighboring cities had volunteered to come and help find two missing girls. After I was found, I was immediately taken to the hospital. I was questioned by police, my parents, detectives, Zoe's parents, and more police. I told them everything. I didn't have the strength to hold back. Ricky, the house, the rituals, waking up next to Zoe, the beast. It wasn't until two pieces of evidence were discovered that my story gained some tiny shred of credibility. They found a heavily mutilated robed body, discovered at a campsite in the woods. His identity was never uncovered. They never found Zoe. It was eventually determined by the police that a group of cultists had kidnapped two innocent girls. The group then killed their leader, left one girl for dead, then stole away with the other. They told me that I never saw Zoe after our kidnapping, and I certainly never saw a beast. It was all made up to cope with trauma. And for a long time, that was the story I believed. With my shattered mind, I created a horrible story to cope with losing my best friend. A story where I had one last chance to say goodbye. A story with a monster. I spent a little time in an institution to regain some semblance of a mind. I spent years in therapy as well. Hell, I'm still in therapy. Between vivid flashbacks, PTSD, and night terrors, I'll probably spend the rest of my life in therapy. It's been almost 30 years and I haven't talked about Zoe since all those years ago. Sure, the people in my life know the rough details. I was kidnapped by a crazy cult. I was nearly killed trying to escape. I haven't told them about Zoe, though. Not my wife, not my therapist, and certainly not my kids. Nobody. It's not as though I had forgotten her. It's just too painful. I honestly hadn't thought about her in years, at least not until I saw that picture of a little girl in a photo from Cambridge. I can only guess what you are thinking now. What chased you two through the woods? If you were gone for 3 days, what happened during that lost time? Why would Zoe's childhood self appear in that picture? What if Zoe's spirit is trapped in the woods still, waiting for you? Or what if Zoe is still alive? I wish I could go back and find Zoe's spirit in the woods. There are so many things I would tell her. I would tell her that I didn't blame her, that it wasn't her fault. I could tell her how I really felt about her. I could hug her one more time, but I can't do that. Zoe is gone, and she's been gone for a long time. That isn't Zoe in the picture. It's me. Me as I was when I was 12 years old in those haunted woods. It's a sign. Seeing that picture made me see the truth for what it really is. I was never meant to escape. I can feel him now, and I know he wants me back there.